This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:05 p.m. on Monday, February 26, 2018, and before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, my Vice Chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Klayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 319, Renew Marijuana License Background Check, sponsored by Representative Josephson. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson. If you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. I will ask committee members, as is the practice here, to hold your questions until the end of the presentation. You may proceed.
Chair Klayman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson. He is unable to be here at this time, and he apologizes for his absence. You have before you House Bill 319, which changes the fingerprinting requirements for the renewal of a marijuana registration. Under current statute, marijuana registration holders are required to turn in a new set of fingerprints on an annual basis. This bill changes that requirement from every year to every 6 years. So this annual requirement for new fingerprints is not standard for other industries. There's only one other industry that requires new fingerprints be turned in after the initial registration, and that is massage therapy. And there is actually legislation active right now to address that issue as well for similar reasons, as I will explain in this bill. The interest in these proposed changes actually came directly from the department. They have a technology called their Aspen system, which actually gives them notice when there is any change in the criminal activity of a license or registration holder who has already turned in their fingerprints. And because of the fact that these measures are already in place, requiring licensees to turn in a fresh set of fingerprints, given the fact that their fingerprints don't change and they're already logged into this database, is a little bit unnecessary in their opinion. The previous version of this bill, as heard in House State Affairs, set this requirement to once every 3 years. That number was suggested by the department. It was an idea proposed by the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board. The committee in House State Affairs decided to amend that to 6 years. It passed with unanimous support, I'd like to note. Few more things. I did a little research as to how this issue is handled in other adult use legal states. I found that some do require new fingerprints to be turned in. However, most have language stating to in regard to their relevant departments that they may require new fingerprints if there's a demonstrated and investigated need. I will summarize with stating that House Bill 319 removes an unnecessary burden to both industry and the state without compromising the public's safety, and make myself available to questions. I'd like to note that Erica McConnell, the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, Brandon Emmett, a member of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and Mr. Gary Lee, the criminal justice planner for the Department of Public Safety, are all available online to answer your questions as well.
Great. Thank you very much. And you got ahead of me, and you've identified three people that are available for questions online, and I won't repeat their names. Are there questions for the bill sponsor or for folks online? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, I think, for probably Ms. McConnell online.
Go ahead.
Which is, what would the policy need to look like for marijuana license holders to be treated the same as alcohol beverage license holders? As far as fingerprinting goes.
Ms. McConnell?
For the record, this is Erica McConnell. I'm the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. The statute on the alcohol side is at AS 0411295, and it states that an applicant for issuance or transfer of a license shall submit fingerprints, and then goes on to say the board may require an applicant for renewal of a license or a conditional contractor's permit under this title to submit fingerprints and pay fees as required by this subsection.
Follow-up?
Representative Christ Tompkins.
And is there a reason from your perspective that the law should not read the same for those in the marijuana industry?
To the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I would note that while both substances are regulated substances, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level. Alcohol, of course, is not. But I would perhaps refer that question to Vice Chair Brandon Emmett. He is the Vice Chair of the Marijuana Control Board, and as noted, he is on the phone.
Would you like Mr. Emmett to answer that question?
I would very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Emmett, did you hear Representative Christ Tompkins' question?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did indeed.
Please state your name and your affiliation.
My name is Brandon Emmett, and I am the Vice Chair of the State of Alaska Marijuana Control Board.
And did you hear Representative Christ Tompkins' question, or should he repeat it?
I did hear his question. So the Marijuana Control Board contemplated this very issue at a previous meeting from ours, and the discussion was centered around two issues. One, that many of the people who are in the marijuana industry or voted for legal marijuana wanted it to be regulated like alcohol, but as Director McConnell said, there are still some issues surrounding its legality on the federal level, and some of the board members have raised concerns about that federal legal status and the previous participation of by unlicensed operators in the marijuana industry. And a couple different ideas were floated. One was for the language to reflect what is in alcohol. Another was for the registration to be every 5 years. And so the Marijuana Control Board settled on a compromise of every 3 years. It kind of that reflected the two sides of that opinion on the board. And so that was the Marijuana Control Board's official position that it should be 3 years.
And I note that Representative Kopp has joined us. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Christ Tompkins? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And maybe to confirm my understanding what happens within the alcohol industry, what I thought I heard Ms. McConnell say, and please chime in if I'm getting this wrong, is that you get fingerprinted upon transfer of alcohol beverage license, and the Alcohol Beverage Control Board may ask for new fingerprints for whatever reason at whatever time, and fingerprints are required when there's a transfer, but there's no recurring fingerprinting requirement. Do I understand that correctly?
Ms. McConnell.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, yes, that is correct.
Follow-up for Mr. Emmett?
Go ahead, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. So I'm trying to understand how it would be a compromise, and you have part of the marijuana board saying every 5 years and part of the marijuana board saying do as they do in alcohol, which seems an even less restrictive measure. How is 3 years, and I realize the legislature has since changed that, but how is 3 years a compromise in that way, and what were the arguments against doing as is done in alcohol?
Through the chair to the representative. So the arguments made were that it should be less restrictive and more restrictive. There definitely was not consensus by the board members as to whether it should stay as is, which is requires it every year, or be essentially open-ended, such as in alcohol. And so after having some discussion, that was what was settled on, was 3 years.
Follow-up?
And as a follow-up, if you look at some of the discussions on the board, the body is often split on many decisions. We have some very robust debate, and so often the votes are split 3-2 or 4-1. It's only on housekeeping items is there generally a 5-0 vote. So you get a lot of different opinions, and then generally come to some sort of a compromise on most of the divisive issues.
Thank you. Maybe just a closing comment along the lines of the questions, if that's...
Well, we're going to get to comments later.
Okay, I think maybe just to flag this for the department and the board, which is, regardless of what one originally thinks, marijuana is now decriminalized and legal now, and I guess I want to hear a compelling reason why there should be a recurring fingerprint requirement as opposed to what happens within the alcohol industry. And besides that the MCB went back and forth on this, there are different schools of thought, what problem is a recurring fingerprint requirement solving besides it's a lot of hassle for a lot of people? And that could be a question for anyone.
And it looked like, Ms. Holland, looked like you may have an answer to that question, or maybe not.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. I'd love to address that.
But remind us who you are for the record. We know, but it helps.
Yeah, for the record, Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson. The benefit to having a recurring requirement for turning in new fingerprints is that requesting the fingerprints triggers a national background check. And although the department has software to track changes in the criminal activity of registration holders on a state level, it does not do so on a national level. So that that is the reason why that is the reason for a recurring fingerprint, so that a national background check can be done every so years in the case that a registration holder were to do something outside of the state and the department would be unaware of it.
Follow up?
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And can you...
He wasn't done with his questions.
can you share why it's in Alaska's interest to be aware of any potential criminal activity that a marijuana license holder might be complicit in outside Alaska, and why there's a greater concern in that than, say, an alcohol beverage license holder?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. I believe Erica McConnell touched on this a little bit earlier, and that is due to the fact that the alcohol and marijuana are different, legally speaking, and marijuana is still illegal on a federal level. So there is incentive to be more restrictive on this industry as compared to alcohol. I don't want to go so far as to speak on their behalf if Miss Erica McConnell would like to add something. But
Representative Christ Tompkins, follow up.
Thank you. I understand the different legal...
Let him choose who he wants to.
I think this is probably a question for Ms. McConnell then. Understand the different statuses between marijuana and alcohol, and that there's, you know, with the Cole memo and all of this other stuff, marijuana is not legal federally. What gives if someone is complicit in federal illegal activity if they hold a marijuana license nationally? I mean, I realize that's sort of bad in general, but does that in any way endanger the legal or decriminalized status of marijuana in Alaska if something does come up on the background check?
This is Erica McConnell, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Through the chair, Representative Price Tompkins. So the statute for marijuana at AS 1738-010-B2 states that the production and sale of marijuana should be regulated so that legitimate taxpaying business people and not criminal actors will conduct sales of marijuana. So that the statute clearly says also later on that certain criminal acts, certain felonies and certain misdemeanors are disqualifying disqualifying situations for people to hold a marijuana license. On the alcohol side, the board has the discretion to evaluate a criminal act on the part of an applicant or a licensee and make a determination whether or not to allow that person to become a licensee. So on alcohol side, it's at the discretion of the board. On the marijuana side, there is statutory language saying that people, certain types of criminal actors are not to be licensees.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So first question is just going to be in general, is there someone here online that can walk the committee through the process by which this fingerprint and background check takes place?
This is Erica McConnell, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, part of the application process includes a number of different forms, a set of fingerprints, and a set of fees. Once all of those things are in our office, we begin processing them, and for the fingerprints, we transfer them over to the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety performs the National Criminal Background Check and then provides us with a report of the results of that check.
And follow up? All right. And now when I've done fingerprints for other licenses in the state, there wasn't necessarily a requirement that anyone take the fingerprints other than myself. So is that the case here as well? Someone provides you a copy of fingerprints that they may have obtained somewhere else, and then they submit that with those forms, and then you in turn process them and send them to the authorities that do the national check.
Representative Eastman, are you suggesting that you can sit in your house and fingerprint yourself, or are you saying you choose who does the fingerprinting and then send that in, done by a third party?
No, my question is to the panel whether or not they do the fingerprinting there or they accept a copy of fingerprints from somebody else.
Some third party, not some individual that just sat in their kitchen and did their own fingerprints.
From someone else.
Right, third party doing the fingerprinting. Okay. Go ahead, Ms. McConnell.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we take fingerprints from third-party businesses. We don't actually do it ourselves. There's a list of people they can go to on our website, businesses that do the fingerprints on the appropriate forms.
Thank you.
And just my own follow-up. So, for example, when one becomes a member of the bar, you get your fingerprints taken once and never again, and I don't even know when I got licensed as an emergency medical technician way back in 1993 whether they took my fingerprints, but they've never asked for those fingerprints again. The only reason to request the fingerprints here as a repeat is actually not because they need the fingerprints, but because that's the way you trigger the national background check. And that can be either to Ms. McConnell or to the bill sponsor.
For the record, Megan Holland, staff director, assistant chair, Chairman Klayman, yes, that is correct. The purpose for getting new fingerprints is to trigger the national background check.
And I see that's triggered a question from Representative Eastman. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And through the chair. So as these background checks are taking place, how does the fee relate to the background check? Is the fee simply the cost of the state to perform that background check, or can you talk to us about this fee?
This is Erica McConnell from AMCO. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's a $47 fee that is set by the Department of Public Safety. We do collect that fee and transfer it to the Department of Public Safety through an RSA. I would refer to the gentleman who I believe is on the line from the Department of Public Safety to explain that particular fee.
And I'm thinking that's Gary Lee with the Bureau of Criminal Records and Identifications of the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Lee, are you available to explain the $37 fee?
Yes, sir, I am.
Go ahead.
My name is Gary Lee. I'm with the Department of Public Safety in the Statewide Services Division. I'm a criminal justice planner. And through the chair, the fees are $37 as a direct charge to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and $10 as a processing fee to digitize the prints and get them prepared to send to the FBI.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair again. Now, if someone were to commit a crime here in Alaska, that would come up without having to do this additional fingerprinting or background check. Now, if someone were to run afoul of federal laws with regard to marijuana, for example, would that information be transmitted to the state, and would we have that, or is this additional background check and fingerprinting, is that what would help us to figure that out?
Through the chair, the Alaska Public Safety Information System only records state charges. If it were a federal charge, we would have no visibility of it unless an additional national fingerprint-based check was conducted.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And I'm interested in the sort of administrative capacity required to process fingerprints. And I guess for all fingerprinting requirements in the state of Alaska right now, this is probably for Mr. Lee, or I'm guessing for Mr. Lee, is that, one full-time person? Is it more than one full-time person? And what the anticipated administrative burden associated with processing fingerprints is with the marijuana industry? Has it been pretty de minimis so far? Has it required that the department bring on slightly additional capacity with this new industry coming online? Forget the recurring fingerprints question, but I want to get a sense of what the operations requirements are.
Through the chair, this is Gary Lee again. The fingerprinting division employs four people currently, and they process all of the cards. We have more people in the records that scan the cards as they come in. It's very broad-based. All of, as you mentioned, massage therapists, attorneys, any number of people go through. So the number of new or changed applicants through the marijuana industry is insignificant and has not caused any additional personnel staffing.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we do have at least one person who wants to provide public testimony. I don't see any questions, and we'll be able to come back to further questions. So I'm going to go ahead and open the public testimony on House Bill 319. Is there anyone in the room who wants to provide testimony about House Bill 319? If you could please come forward. State your name for the record.
My name is Paul Disdier. It's spelled D-I-S-D-I-E-R, and I am the general manager of the Fireweed Factory, LLC. We are a state-licensed cultivating facility, and we have a retail store here in Juneau. And I would like to just state that we have 9 LLC members that comprise the Fireweed Factory, and it is a rather burden to us every year to make sure that all of our LLC members are going to get the fingerprinting done, get the paperwork back to us so that we can get it to the state and get our license renewed. It's usually in the summertime. Last year was the first time that we went through this, and one of our LLC members was in Europe. Another one was on vacation with their children. So this year, fortunately, we know how to sort of steer away from that and have already notified all of our LLC members that they need to start the process of getting their fingerprinting done, their paperwork to, so if this were to be extended to 10 years, 6 years, 3 years, whatever, it would certainly be less of a burden on us each year if that were the case. And I'm not really sure if we probably have more LLC members than other marijuana entities in the state, but I mean, funding for these businesses is usually done with a group of investors, and so I'm sure that they're under the same kind of problems that we have every year. So I would appreciate it, if you would consider this to at least get it changed from 3 to something.
All right. I see that Representative Eastman has a question for you. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, in the applications that you've submitted on behalf of yourself or others, have those applications or any of them ever been denied because of something that came up on the background check or fingerprints?
No. Everyone in our LLC had no previous legal problems, so that the fingerprints, all passed through just fine. I mean, and I'm sure, some of them may have had some minor issues in their life earlier or younger, when they were younger, myself included, where you were fingerprinted, but I mean, they were for a really marginal, at least mine was for marginal sort of a situation. So, we have an attorney who is an investor. We have the husband of a doctor who is an investor. I mean, I think you're going to see those kind of people are the type of people that are investing in this industry. And, it makes one feel like we're still outlaws in a way, you know what I mean, where you don't trust us. We want to make sure every year that you're not doing any kind of illegal activity. I can understand that. I don't want to see any illegal activity coming into this industry, but, I think you can trust a lot of the people that are in this business.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Through the chair. Now, obviously, I'm sure others, competitors, others in the industry in the state. Have you heard or are you aware of anyone else here in Alaska who has applied and been turned down because of the background check or something in that process?
No, I haven't heard of a single soul.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to provide testimony this morning or this afternoon? I don't see anyone. I have one person online, Jana Welton. Ms. Welton, did you want to provide public testimony today?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, this is Jana Welton, located in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm an attorney that represents a good amount of the industry. And, we've done probably 70-plus applications, and we haven't had anything rejected for purposes of, somebody not having the correct criminal history. I would just like to support this bill. I've got companies that have up to 20 investors, and wrangling up, in a two-week time frame to do our renewal applications, 20-plus people fingerprints in the middle of summer is kind of tough. And so I really hope that this committee passes this piece of legislation, because I think it would help the industry move a lot more fluid and kind of echoing the last commenter, not treating these legitimate businesses so much like criminals that they have to be checked every 12 months to see if they've gotten into any trouble.
Representative Christ Tompkins has a question for you.
Thank you, Ms. Weltzien. And would you have any objection if your industry were treated the same as the alcohol industry for the purposes of checking criminality, fingerprint checks? That is, that the board could require checks whenever the board wanted, and that all transfers would require checks. But other than that, there's no assumed recurring fingerprinting requirement.
I wouldn't have any objection, except for the point of optics. We're trying to not encourage any federal intervention activity here in the state of Alaska, and I think if we you know, get rid of the fingerprint requirement completely, which I know is not exactly what you said, but making it discretionary, I think that could give a little bit more leverage to the federal government to say, hey, you guys aren't being proactive to make sure that these licensees don't have felonies. I think just a couple examples, if that actually happened, would be really negative on our ability to keep this industry independent and completely state regulated.
Follow up? Representative Price Tompkins.
That's a good point. And I think that kind of brings into focus some previous testimony. How would every 10 years sound?
Every 10 years. Yeah, I mean, I guess that would be fine. I think 6 years is fine. There's just a lot that can happen every 10 years, but I guess I don't really have too much of an opinion between the difference of 6 years and 10 years. I think the entry into the market, you should get your fingerprints and background checks. The transfers, you definitely should. And maybe every 10 years is a good mark for people to re-look at their criminal history and make sure that they've, you know, remained compliant. And then maybe with that, every year you attest through a written affidavit that you haven't had any new criminal activities pop up. Might also be a good way to keep the federal government from interfering with our market.
Representative Eastman,
you have a question?
thank you. Now, what would you think about contrasting those involved in the marijuana industry with lawyers, for example? And would you want those involved in the marijuana industry to be more frequently background checked than attorneys, or the same? Any comments on that?
Oh, man. I think attorneys have way more leeway sometimes than they should. I mean, they have a fiduciary duty to their clients and their officers of the court, and I think they should be background checked a little more often than they are. They certainly get in more trouble than marijuana businesses, I think, overall.
Thank you.
Some of them get in trouble by joining the legislature. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. As a legal representative for licensees, are there any, you mentioned felonies, are there any disqualifying misdemeanors that can prevent a licensee from being renewed or cause them to lose their license?
Yes, there are. If you just give me one moment, I can pull it up and actually cite it for you. I'm sure Erica's got it at the tip of her tongue. Okay, so the misdemeanor for, and I'm just trying to get to it.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Cobb, while you're looking Representative Cobb, go ahead.
On the National Crime Information Center, NCIC, background check, those find felonies. They don't find misdemeanors. Only felonies are uploaded into NCIC unless we're doing something brand new. So if there's disqualifying misdemeanors, I mean, you can do a state-by-state check, but that's very exhaustive and time-intensive, and I'm just wondering, maybe the DPS person can answer that.
Okay.
But if in fact, one of the purposes for the background check and fingerprinting is to identify all disqualifying offenses, I don't think the standard NCIC background check is doing it.
Mr. Lee, you may be able to answer that question.
And this is Janet. So just to clarify, I thought the question was, are there any disqualifying misdemeanors in the statute? And yes, there are. It's a misdemeanor crime. It's in 306.10, Section C, misdemeanor crime involving a controlled substance, violence against a person, use of a weapon, or dishonesty within the 5 years, or number three after that has within 2 years before submitting the application been convicted of a Class A misdemeanor. So it sounds to me that these federal background checks don't pick up on these misdemeanors. So I'm not really sure how they would pick up on the misdemeanors. I guess that's state by state check that the previous commenter was mentioning.
And Mr. Lee, can you confirm that nothing has changed since when Representative Kopp was working in the police department?
Through the chair, this is Gary Lee with the Department of Public Safety, and basically that is correct. The federal records, the national records, do indicate if there is a record and point to the state that it originated at. So to do a full background check, you would have to inquire of each state that the federal database says has a record of an individual.
So in other words, the federal record would show another state's felony, and if there was a misdemeanor in that state, it wouldn't say what the misdemeanor is. It would just reflect there was a misdemeanor charge in that other state, and then we'd have to follow up with that other state.
Through the chair, that's correct. But it's through the national communication system. It's not like you have to actually call the state. It's a message transmission to pull up the digitized data records.
Okay. Okay, I think that answers Representative Kopp's question. Representative Eastman, that looks like it got you on another follow-up. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was just a little bit confused. So does that follow-up take place automatically, or does something else need to trigger that follow-up? So under our current process now for these licenses, if I'm applying for a license here in Alaska and I don't know, let's say 20 years ago I had a misdemeanor in some other state, is the board going to have access to that information of what that misdemeanor was so that they can at least rule out that it's not disqualifying?
Through the chair, this is Gary Lee. The full background check would inquire of the state that originated that charge to find out what that charge was and what its disposition was.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. I don't have anybody else showing up online that wants to testify. I don't believe there's anyone else in the room that wants to testify, so I'm going to no one's jumped up when I just said that, so I'm going to close public testimony at this time. And my plan is to hold this bill for further review. I do. It's clear that Representative Christ Tompkins is pondering a potential amendment. I'm not scheduling a time for amendments at this point, but if you are interested in an amendment to this bill, don't let the grass grow under your feet. Our next order of business is House Bill 316, Restrict Access to Marijuana Criminal Records, sponsored by Representative Drummond. This is the second hearing of the bill on the Judiciary Committee. It's my intention to move on to amendments today, but before we do so, I'd like to invite the bill sponsor to come forward and make any brief comments before we move on to further questions and amendments. Actually, we'll get the comments and then we'll get right into amendments. If you could please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Klayman and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I'm staff of Representative Harriet Drummond, who is attending our Resources Committee at this time. We left off on House Bill 316 with some questions from members of the committee that and I would like to speak to those. And also, there are members from courts, law, and DPS, either online or in the room, who might be able to clarify any questions that might be brought up while in this time. First, starting with Representative Christ Tompkins, had a question about how any sort of expungement or any sort of kind of dealings with people who had been punished or imprisoned because of prohibition when the United States was under once that had ended, and because it was more of a federally done law, and it was in the it was amendment in the Constitution, it was kind of done with once they ended prohibition, the federal government left it up to the states, so we're kind of doing it in reverse, where the states have been ending prohibition on cannabis and marijuana rather than the federal government doing it. So That's kind of what I discovered from that. So it was left to the state's decision what to do, how to address the remainder of the sentences that were given out during prohibition. Representative Eastman had a question about job applications and how would someone answer a job application if they fit the criteria into the bill. And essentially what they would say on the job application is, yes, I have been convicted. However, as an employer, you may not have access to it because it is a crime that was addressed and is now legal. So that's what I gathered from doing the research on those two questions. And other than that, I just wanted to be able to get those back on the record. So,
all right. So that's going to allow us to move on to amendments at this time. Before I do so, I would like to put on record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming amendments to the bill. I have received one amendment, which was actually made at the request, I believe, of the department. And so I'm going to move amendment number one, which you all should have copies of amendment number one. So I'd move amendment number one.
Object for purposes of discussion?
And I would actually ask the bill sponsor to speak to amendment number one.
Absolutely. Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair, to the committee. Amendment number one just basically clarifies that the age for this to apply, the age of the individual would have to be 21 years or older during the issuing of the citation. This was something that we had kind of worked out with Department of Law and the courts just to kind of speak to. When we had originally drafted the bill, we thought that because it would be giving the citation that would have been given would have been included a minor in possession of or a minor using whatever it may be, that it wouldn't override it. However, this amendment does clarify that the member, the person, the individual would have had to have been 21 years at the time, which is what is legal now.
Follow up?
So are there any potential convictions out there?
Actually, that wasn't follow-up. Representative Eastman had a question. I apologize. I got my...
Thank you. Through the chair. Is there the possibility of any convictions out there for something that occurred when someone was 18, 19, or 20?
Yes, there are convictions out there. And our office has been kind of notified of some. However, if they were 19 or 20 or... 18 or whatever age below the age of 21 when the citation was given, then this would not pertain to them.
Follow up, Representative Eastman.
So doesn't that kind of create an interesting situation where if I'm 21 and I do something, then that's confidential, but if I was younger, then it's not confidential?
Patrick Verstale, through the chair, to Representative Eastman. The idea behind the bill is that if you would have been legally possessing marijuana at the time before the state legalized it, that we are going to make your record confidential. If you were underage, then you would not, then even if you had it now and you were underage, then it would still be minor in possession.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I see no other questions as to amendment number one. Is the objection maintained?
I withdraw the objection.
Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment number one is approved. That bill brings back before us House Bill 316 as amended. This is the time for final discussion.
One question.
We can actually go back to your questions. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, one of the things that was brought up last time you were here dealt with charges. Now, what's the sponsor's position on whether or not this confidentiality should deal with when this is the only charge or when it's more broader? Do you remember the conversation?
Yes.
Okay.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair, to Representative Eastman. This bill applies to the standalone charges. So if there's any other charges included that with that, and that's other possession charges, any sort of other charges that were gone through and convicted, this is just the conviction of possession, is which this bill only applies to the conviction of possession. So it would have to be on their record.
and follow up?
Representatives.
All right. So, and I'm asking for the sponsor's position on this, but you know, there's two options. You can narrowly tailor it to this situation where the only thing a person was charged with was this, and then the only thing they were convicted of was this, or you can have it more broad to relate to this could have been one of many different charges. And what, which of those two options is the sponsor siding on?
You mean what does the bill do?
Between those two options, I wanted to know where the sponsor came down, because that was the topic of conversation last hearing.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of order.
Representative Kopp.
It doesn't really matter what the sponsor wants to do. The question is, what does the bill do?
Well, and that's what I was getting to. And, yeah. I mean, I guess, Representative Eastman, if this is the bill sponsor's bill, isn't their position reflected by the bill they've submitted?
Well, I'm asking the sponsor's representative to confirm that here.
You can confirm that the bill represents the sponsor's intent.
Yes, and Patrick Steele, through the chair, that the bill does reflect the sponsor's intent. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? That brings us to comments on House Bill 316. Anyone want to make comments before we get to the question of moving the bill? Everyone's quiet. All right. Representative Christ Tompkins might have a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move version 30-LF1017/O of HB 316 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 316 will move from committee. What we're going to do is we're going to take an at ease to sign the paperwork, and then we will stay at ease because there's two members that are in a meeting that I expect them back any minute, but one of them has an amendment to the next bill, so it's kind of hard to take up the next bill without the other two members here. So we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on record, our last and final order of business today, if I can find my place, is House Bill 330, DNR Disclosure of Confidential Information, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the fourth hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. To provide a brief recap, on Friday, the committee adopted Amendment Number 1, and over the weekend, we received a second amendment from Representative Ledoux, who was here a moment ago. Today, I'd like to move forward with amendments, and I will note again for the record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical amendments and conforming changes to the bill. And that brings us now to Amendment Number 2. Representative Ledoux, may I have a motion?
Can we have an at ease?
Brief at ease. Representative Ledoux, a motion on Amendment Number 2.
I move Amendment Number 2.
And would you like your staff to come and explain Amendment Number 2?
Yes.
Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you can explain Amendment Number 2.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. Greg Smith, staff to Representative Ledoux. The intent of this amendment is to restrict the disclosures of confidential information made by the Commissioner of DNR to royalty or net profit share audits or appeals. This further limits or kind of tightens in the authority that the department was seeking. The maker of the amendment feels that it strikes a balance of between the concerns expressed by industry and then the needs of the department to efficiently process these cases, and this language will still allow them to process the vast majority of the cases to which they need to disclose confidential information and create protective orders.
Questions, Representative Kopp? And I would note we're going to get Ed King up here to tell us the department's position as well.
Okay. Oh,
okay.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Just to note, I think I will object to the amendment for purposes of discussion, just to make sure.
Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins. I should have asked for that objection beforehand. I appreciate your attention to detail. Mr. King, if you could come forward and let us know the department's perspective on these amendments. And be sure to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Mr. Chairman, the amendment would further narrow the scope of what the Commissioner's authority would be instead of being a general power to adjudicate and resolve issues resolving appeals or audits related to information that's held confidential. This amendment would restrict that to only royalty issues and net profit share issues. Mr. Chairman, it is the case that the vast majority of these issues that require these types of protective orders are, in fact, in the royalty audit and net profit share of that variety. However, there are issues outside of royalties and net profit shares that we would prefer to be able to also adjudicate under the protective order. So the preference of the department would be that the amendment does not pass. However, if it is the will of the committee, we still appreciate the efforts.
Representative Kopp, you had a question, and does that answer the question, or do you have follow-up?
One more, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Is it would it be your understanding that this would also protect the confidentiality of geological data or sensitive data about what a field might contain?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, with the amendment, we would no longer have that authority to issue protective orders to resolve those types of issues. Without the amendment, our reading of the bill is that we would have the ability to resolve those issues through the commissioner's office without having to go to the court to get a protective order.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And through the chair, Mr. King, you mentioned that the strong majority of instances in which a protective order would be issued would relate to royalties and net profit share. You mentioned, but there are some other issues that could take advantage of this tool were it availed to the commissioner. What are examples of those other issues?
Representative Chris Thompson, through the chair, the specific example that we have had to deal with is related to private property owners with a mineral interest surrounding a geologic structure. So a resource, and specifically in oil and gas, where when we make a decision related to the extent of the resource, whether it or and to what extent it provides revenue to the resource owner, our decision could impact how much money that individual would be earning from the production of those resources. This is a fairly rare circumstance, but just an example that we can talk about. We did have this issue in the Cook Inlet about 10 years ago, and we couldn't resolve the issue internally because we didn't have the ability to disclose that confidential data to the property owner because the data was collected by the operator. So in that circumstance, the audit sat in the commissioner's office until the appellant finally went to the court, and the court issued a protective order, and then we were able to resolve it.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Are there other examples besides the one you just described?
Representative Christ Thompson, through the chair, that is a very similar situation to that one is currently being litigated now. And other than that, I'm not aware of any other circumstances.
I just have a follow-up on that question, then I'll get to represent. Is litigating the audit, or are they litigating the protective order?
Mr. Chairman, it's a different and separate issue related to the same. But it is currently in the Superior Court around the protective order in that case has not been issued yet.
And is that the main thing they're in the court over? They in the court over the audit as well?
That is not related to an audit, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Reinbold.
Are we in comments or questions?
Questions.
Okay, so my question to you is the regional native corporations own the minerals below the surface. So if this amendment does not pass, would that allow the state to also get information on the regional native corporations information?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, the the information that we're asking, the bill itself doesn't provide any abilities to get new information from the department. The department doesn't have the ability under this bill to get any new information. The information is being given us to us by the producer. The question is, how can we use that information to adjudicate when there's an appeal? So in the circumstance that you're talking about, the Mental Health Trust or the Native Corporation would have a lease with the producer, and so they would have to administer and adjudicate their own appeals around that issue. In the specific case that we're talking about, where we have this private landowner adjacent to a resource, there may or may not be a lease issue that needs to be resolved there. And in those circumstances, the appellant is bringing the appeal and has standing because of their financial interest as a adjacent landowner. And in those situations, we can't share the producer's information with this private third party without some protections over that confidential data.
I'll hold my comments, but I'm very supportive of the amendment.
All right. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And just a question for the maker of the amendment. Could you give us another example of kind of how you envision this amendment, you know, having a positive impact on a particular situation?
Well, I guess I feel that in the absence of a compelling circumstance, and one example that's being litigated today and another example from 10 years ago doesn't provide that compelling circumstance to me, that the ability, I feel very uncomfortable with the ability of the department to release what otherwise would be confidential information to somebody outside of the department. And so I realize why you need the bill, but I would just feel far more comfortable with the bill if it's limited to the circumstances that you describe where it is actually most needed.
Thank you.
All right, don't see any other questions about amendment number two, so comments on amendment number two. Representative Reinbold, I think you had one.
I'm just very supportive. I think we don't need to chase investment a lot, you know, out of this state, and I do believe in private property rights, but I understand there's a point in time, you know, where some information is needed, but I don't think we need to give the government wide open to information that some may hold very, very close. I think that like I said, there's specific situations, and that's why overall I'm not, you know, striking down or opposing the bill. But I think that sometimes you need to narrow the focus. And when we had committee hearings I think it was last week in regards to this, they said this was the primary, what they needed, and I think the bill is observing that. This narrows the focus, and at the time they had no objection to it. So I'm gonna support my colleague to the left of me and vote yes on this amendment.
Okay. I would note this is actually our fourth time hearing the bill. The amendment they didn't have objection to was amendment number one that we adopted last week. They hadn't seen amendment number two till they came here today.
And can I respond, Mr.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so basically, when we had people before us over the last several weeks, I guess it's been, they said the primary responsibility was being even with this issue she brought up, because I remember we were talking back and forth and sending notes back and forth on this, and at the time there was no objection to it, and that's why I will be supporting it.
Okay. Any other comments as to the amendment? Representative Stutes, was that a hand up?
No.
Okay. Is the objection maintained?
I will maintain the objection.
So as to amendment number two, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Yay.
Yay.
Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Cox?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Price Tompkins?
Nay.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
Yay.
Yay. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. 5 yays, 2 nays.
So by a vote of 5-2, amendment number 2 has been approved. I don't have any further amendments. Are there any further comments? Or comments with regard to House Bill 330 as amended. And I will continue to ask folks to keep your comments to 3 minutes. Anybody want to make comments on the bill? Don't see anyone. Representative Christ Tompkins, may I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-GH2820/A of HB 330 as amended several times with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 330 will move from committee. And with that, we will stand adjourned for the day, except you can't leave until you sign the paperwork. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, February 28th at 1 p.m. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is 2:13 p.m.